You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. Joining me on the line is Mark Anderson, the editor of American Free Press newspaper. Mark just returned from an economic conference in New Hampshire titled Bretton Woods 2. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Dave.
Mark, tell our listeners the significance of this conference, I guess starting with where it was held in Bretton Woods. Didn't something happen there 50, 60, 70 years ago?
Yeah, the significance is really hard to even overstate, Dave. In the waning days of World War II, there was a meeting called Bretton Woods, and it was named after the area in northern New Hampshire where the Mount Washington Hotel is, a splendid, grand hotel nestled in the mountains, which looks something like the Swiss Alps, only smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And in this beautiful hotel, you had Lord John Maynard Keynes, a noted British economist, and other heavyweights of the time, reconstructing the post-World War II economic architecture, basically putting together a different sort of world. They literally created the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank at the first Bretton Woods conference in the summer of 1944, and the same number of nations, 44 nations, were represented there. And it was sort of a United Nations of financiers and their fellow travelers to put together the post-war architecture. So the significance of Bretton Woods II, having happened April 8th through 11, 2011, more than 60 years later, as noted, can hardly be overstated. This time, the difference is it's more of a think tank, the Institute for New Economic Thinking, or INET. Before, the first Bretton Woods was more of currently serving officials, along with some advisors and politicos and all that. So there's a little bit different membership or different makeup now, but the place is significant for the reason just stated, that they would have another conference after more than 60 years after the first one. And, of course, the added significance is the U.S. is in terrific economic turmoil, very, very disturbing. And it's really a depression kind of disguised or repackaged as a recession, and it's lingering on and on. The people are hurting really badly, of course, across the world, too. And so the United States is particularly vulnerable. The Bretton Woods II people say they're looking for answers to our current dilemma, but one can't help but wonder if it's going to end up with the same old song and dance, where those that say that we need a cure and a correction to our perilous course are in fact those that put us on this perilous course in the first place,
mm-hmm.
with their time-tested ideas, ideas that have tested out to be very faulty.
And who exactly are the or were the participants at Bretton Woods II? Any significant names?
Yes, Bretton Woods II has a number of significant names, not just in the name of the people, but in the names of, you know, their affiliations. A lot of times, going through the list of 94 major speakers, there's about 200 people there in all, and of those, 94 spoke or offered some sort of remarks. And you had, in the more recognizable realms, you had former Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Gordon Brown, who, of course, was just succeeded by David Cameron. And an affiliation here, we have the Executive Director for Financial Stability of the Bank of England, Andy Haldane. So we have the Bank of England. We have the former British PM. And then notably, we have journalists, and we wonder if they'll write anything about this. Chrystia Freeland, editor-at-large of Reuters. John Cassidy of The New Yorker. The Bank for International Settlements is represented, a very powerful but little-known bank out of Switzerland. The Brookings Institute, a very noted globalist institution, is represented there. And a number of other individuals and organizations. The London School of Economics has someone there. The London School of Economics is notorious as an incubator for those that would serve in some function perpetuating the world banking system that is shaking down the world with compound interest and basically collateralizing every country and every man, woman, and child on earth. That's how central banking works. The whole world is their collateral. And so on and so forth. Going on through the list, of course, you can't forget the towering figure of Paul Volcker, the former Fed chairman. Paul himself stands, they say, about 6'5", 6'6", maybe taller. He's sort of towering over this, having just departed from a Obama economics advisory panel, now getting busy with the Bretton Woods II crowd. He was replaced by a Mr. Immelt, a top official with General Electric, who now is advising the Obama administration. Jeffrey Immelt is his name. American Free Press just covered an article about that. So Yeah, you have Harvard, you have all sorts of academics, you have the Reserve Bank of India there. And Niall Ferguson, a professor of history at Harvard University, he's veritable because he speaks at a lot of the World Affairs Council meetings and Chicago Council on Global Affairs and all the smaller local affiliates and regional groups that are related to the New York-based Council on Foreign Relations. And so it's quite a sterling cast, either in terms of who it is or where they're from. They wouldn't meet like this during this kind of economic situation in the way they went about their meeting, which was very closed, unless they had a very good reason. And me and an AFP associate were there on April 10 on a Sunday to observe what we could firsthand. We went up there dreadfully lacking sleep, and we managed to crawl our way up there and observe the situation.
Now, as far as the mainstream media covering the event, I did a search in Reuters, and I came up with nothing, although there was somebody there, as you say. Forbes does have a little piece on it, but it's more of a satire than anything else, it looks like. George Soros, is he kind of the MC of this event, or was he the MC of this event?
Yes, he was the organizer through his Institute for New Economic Thinking, which reportedly got a $50 million endowment, probably from George himself, to get that organization, the INET organization, started. And that, of course, put it on this course to do the Bretton Woods 2 conference. As American Free Press reported in the April 18 edition of 2011, Soros first telegraphed this idea, so to speak, in a Japan Times Online article in November 2009, where he foresaw the need and called for the idea of another Bretton Woods conference. And come to find out just today when I was doing a little research in Washington, D.C. at the AFP office, there's also a Bretton Woods committee that Soros is affiliated with that actually goes around and explains and promotes the IMF and the World Bank, these siblings that the Bretton Woods people are so proud of having created in the waning days of World War II. But the IMF, just to take an example, is basically a financial mafia that takes vulnerable countries and restructures their debt, puts them on an austerity footing, and the entire country then is crunched under the weight of even more onerous financial imperatives than they already are going through in their financial downturns. IMF plans and debt restructuring have been tried across the world, I believe in Greece, among others, and it's bad news. I've never read a good account of an IMF takeover of a country where the IMF basically seizes all the control of the financial direction of the nation. So if this is what is born out of the first Bretton Woods, I kind of shudder as to what sort of progeny might be born out of this next one, with the U.S. in such a vulnerable position, so hopelessly in debt and really essentially bankrupt and broke in the final analysis. So you judge things by their fruits. And so far, there's no reason to have any excessive confidence in Bretton Woods 2 that it will do any good. I wish they'd give us a reason to think that maybe they'll help the world. They just don't have the track record to prove that.
Mm-hmm. So I guess you're saying the IMF and the World Bank are kind of like international loan sharks.
Yeah, the IMF in particular. The World Bank's a little more obscure. They don't seem to be as in the news or as proactive, maybe you might say, as the IMF. I don't know all there is to know about both those organizations. The U.S. has notoriously paid a much higher than required share, or a much higher than it ought to kind of share, in the donations toward the IMF fund, you know, the allotments that are paid by each member nation.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. pays an inordinately high share for NATO, and the U.S. traditionally has paid an inordinately high share for the IMF. The U.S. taxpayers and the Congress always seem to get stuck with a disproportionately high part of the bill. It's quite disturbing.
Mm. The IMF is, and the World Bank, I guess they're part of the United Nations. They're connected to the U.N., is that right?
I think they fall under the general heading of the UN. Like NATO, for example, was created by the Atlantic Council under the aegis of Article 51 of the United Nations Charter. And NATO was created, of course, in 1949. So, yeah, I think the UN Charter kind of provides a basis, certainly for NATO. Now, the UN wasn't really fully born until 45, and Bretton Woods was in 44.
Mm-hmm.
We got to be a little careful there. I think they have a similar character, but I don't think we can say with certainty that the World Bank and IMF are literally coming out of the UN Charter, because the UN Charter was not fully formulated until 1945. But they are of that same character. They're cut from a similar cloth, to be sure.
The Bretton Woods 2 conference, which, as you said, is more of a think tank, they don't really have any say in any public policy. Is anybody taking these guys seriously?
you have to be careful. The distinction between public and private anymore in the 21st century is tenuously thin. Like if you take the United Nations climate conferences and Agenda 21 from the Rio de Janeiro conference way back in 1992, the Earth Charter and different things that have come up, these things are soft law. They're recommendations of these esteemed councils, and they have a funny way of becoming hard law later on. The cap and trade and all the carbon footprint things, I think, are outgrowths of the UN's environmental conferences of years ago. And after a fashion, they tend to become legislation or pop up in some form of legislation, maybe even an executive order. When you have Paul Volcker involved, who's just been advising the president, you can just about bet that some sort of proposal, some sort of legislative measure, some sort of presidential initiative will in some way reflect these things. These guys aren't going to get together just for academic exchanging of opinions and talking shop. They're going to get together with Gordon Brown and Paul Volcker and people from the Bank of England to effect change, because our entire financial system is privately controlled. And so that distinction between a private think tank and government policy is so thin. And it stands to reason, and there's every reason to believe, and there's plenty of history to show that soft law can become hard law sooner or later, and in fact does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. But I just want to make the point that this is a private think tank in relation to, for example, the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank. This is just a bunch of guys getting together, similar to, I guess you could say, Bilderberg, right? Or Trilateral Commission.
Yeah, well, the Bilderberg Group is a world planning commission. When the people get together at Bilderberg, you do have some people that are currently serving in public capacities, like David Cameron was at the Spain Bilderberg meeting in 2010. I believe he was already British PM or was well on his way, but he was already in parliament. He was already in the government.
Mm-hmm.
So Bilderberg carries a little more weight in that some of the people are currently serving as public officials. They're not former public officials. But the revolving doors are quick and easy between former Fed chairman over to advise the Obama administration like Paul Volcker has done. And then next thing you know, you're at the INET Bretton Woods 2 conference like we're talking about. And so these guys go through revolving doors all the time, from so-called public service back to private practice. And they carry their baggage from one to the other. You know, the Federal Reserve Act was dreamt up at a private meeting, and next thing you know, it was the Federal Reserve Act two or three years later, after they met at Jekyll Island, Georgia, in the late fall of 1910. And that was just a private meeting, just a handful of people, bankers. There was one currently serving senator. Nevertheless, they created an entire central bank out of a meeting of just a handful of people, most of whom were private.
Mm-hmm. And it only took them about 3 years to do that, right?
Right. And so that private-public distinction is something that can mean something, and it should mean something, but it really doesn't when push comes to shove, when the stakes are high enough.
Now, Soros did say, as you mentioned in that November 09 article in Japan Times Online, he did say that he wanted to rearrange the entire financial order, right?
Yeah, that was his word. You can interpret those four words, rearrange entire financial order, maybe in a positive way or in a negative way. But the thing you can't get around is the word entire. Rearrange doesn't mean too much. Financial order is kind of meaningful. But when you see that word entire, that means the whole thing. To even have that kind of hubris, that sort of assumption that he is just sort of an automatic shoe-in, that he is to take that privilege and just rearrange it because he feels like it. That kind of arrogance is just a little hard to fathom. It's amazing that anyone would have that kind of cojones, if you'll pardon the expression, or that sort of self-reverence to think they're even capable of, much less whether they should, as a moral question, try and rearrange the entire financial order. Sometimes I think these people just need to drink a glass of wine and just go home and forget all about it, and we'd be all much better off.
Did you get into the conference?
No, tried though we might. We were not able to get in. We weren't approved media, much like a situation where I tried to interview a particular prisoner who's locked up near Fort Worth, Texas for alleged tax evasion, and the Bureau of Prisons called back and said that American Free Press was not considered a real newspaper.
That was nice.
It was a similar situation to that, although I didn't get the official word, we were just snubbed in every approach we took. We tried pretty much every approach that we could take in the small amount of time that me and my associate were up there. I wish we could have spent more time. What we did see was a kind of toned down sort of Bilderberg setting, some black sedans being driven around by the drivers of these elitists and their camp followers who were at the INET meeting. And they were going around gassing up. They didn't have their esteemed guests in their cars at the time. We observed that. We talked to some of the townspeople. We found someone up there who was very concerned, and he's going to distribute American Free Press up there on a constant basis. So we did some newspaper circulation work while we were there, and we talked to some of the hotel staff and drivers of the hotel buses, the shuttle buses that they use to drive their patrons to certain places. All of them said that if they talked, their jobs were considered in jeopardy. Those that would talk only spoke in generalities. Wait staff said that when they would take the food in, they would have to leave the room immediately once the food was at the table, and they couldn't linger around to where they would hear what was being said. And they volunteered that. I didn't ask them that question. They just volunteered that. I know they were being sincere. The townsfolk were largely unaware of it. It's a very rural area. Though some were vaguely aware, there was no press around at all. A check of the papers over the weekend, Boston Globe, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, didn't yield any hard copy articles. And when I was looking today online, I certainly saw very little in terms of online, on the scene, or timely news on these. Like you mentioned, the Forbes thing, there's these anecdotal, almost satirical items, small things floating around. But back in the 40s, when the first Bretton Woods conference happened, there was major press coverage. And the delegates would come outside and pose for group photos for the press and all these things. And at this one, there was no delegates or participants standing outside, nobody out for a smoke where they could be photographed. The entire porch is screened in where you can't see in. So even if you had a big zoom lens, you wouldn't really get anything. And so the police, regular police, there was no upper level military or fancy security guards, none of that. Just the local posse was there, and they sealed the place off, and no one would return my calls from the INET organization asking for a press conference, press releases, or anything like that. So AFP was snubbed. I halfway expected to see maybe a news crew come by or two, maybe with their television transmission vans, you know, and set up some sort of remote, but nothing of the sort. It was just very, very sparse news coverage other than what AFP did just as it was starting. We learned about it a little more late than I would have preferred, but that's just the way it goes, I guess. We're on top of it now, and we're going to be running the names, and that's going to be in our number 17 edition, and there'll be a lot more on this. We had the first article in the number 16 edition. Intermittently, there'll be more as the year goes on, as Bilderberg approaches in June and so on.
Besides American Free Press actually breaking the story, the only other media that covered it was Forbes. And as I said earlier, that was kind of like a satirical piece. There's a website for the Institute for New Economic Thinking, ineteconomics.org. And on that site, they do have the list of the people who were in attendance. Larry Summers was there also.
That's right. And what you said, Dave, is very revealing in its own way. That's the whole thing. ineteconomics.org did publish a list of confirmed speakers and did put out some marginally informative information, and still there's no media coverage. I happened to run into Bob Schieffer, the Face the Nation anchor host, at the Dallas airport as I was heading to Washington, D.C. to what I thought was going to be helping Jim Tucker, the veteran AFP reporter, with covering trilaterals. All of a sudden, this Bretton Woods 2 falls in my lap, and I'm suddenly making last-minute plans to go up there and do what I could. But on the way into D.C., I run into Bob Schieffer, and I strike up a conversation with him, and I say, Bob, nice to meet you. You know, I confirmed that it was who I thought it was. And I said, so what you got going? This is on a Friday. What you got going on your show Sunday? And he said something about the government shutdown. So I wrote him a note and handed it to him and said, well, here's something really interesting. They haven't had a meeting in more than 60 years, and CBS News could be right on top of it. And he looked at my note that said Bretton Woods 2, and he said, yeah, I heard about this. That's an exact quote. And then I said, well, then you can thank me later for your great cutting-edge stories. I was very humorous about it, very lighthearted. I checked, and maybe the topic was already in the pipeline at CBS. I understand these things, but it was just a typical government shutdown, budget cuts kind of interview. There was nothing about Bretton Woods. But he had told me that as of Friday, he wasn't even sure what he was having on there. So here's some of the information just right there. So these mainstream reporters have some of their work taken care of for them, and AFP is always having to pick up the mantle and do what they should be doing, and that's calling some of these participants and asking them to explain themselves, what is this? This country's in dire straits. We can't just have behind-the-scenes closed-door meetings going on without knowing what's going on. This just isn't going to work anymore.
I'm constantly amazed, not surprised anymore, but I'm constantly amazed at how the mainstream media decides not to cover certain events in lockstep, in monolithic fashion.
Correct. If you were CBS like Bob Schieffer, why not be the guy that covers it so you scoop the competition? Or is it that they're not really the competition?
Right.
They're just different appendages of the same monolithic media with different names on them. Maybe that's being unfair, but sometimes that's the way it strikes me.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's being unfair. It's like I said, it's an amazing thing that they move in lockstep. This is big news when former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker, who advises the current CEO of America, Barack Obama, whatever his name is.
Whoever he is,
everything's sealed, so we really don't know who he is. When he is at a conference, when Joseph Stiglitz is at a conference, when former British PM Gordon Brown is at a conference, when George Soros is at a conference.
And it's all the same conference.
You were talking about Tucker before. So Tucker said in one of his latest articles at AFP, it was great. He said if a couple of hundred celebrities or sports figures or entertainers were gathering at a location, the media would be all over them. But here, some of the biggest financial luminaries in the world, in history, are gathering together. And it's like Daffy Duck is on stage. You can hear the crickets outside.
Not only are they gathering together, they're gathering together at a historic place where a big meeting once happened before, during a time now of extreme economic turmoil.
Right.
You know, they're not in there talking about basketball or basket weaving or, you know, how to make the best Texas hot chili. I mean, this is serious business here. These are not winemakers or brewers. These are economic hocus-pocus types, and that's academics mostly. They're so knowledgeable, they're stupid, half of them.
Right.
At any rate, they've been taught a lot of propaganda that they believe themselves, and their recommendations tend to be almost freakishly overcomplicated. Money is supposed to be an inert thing that simply facilitates buying and selling and puts production, that is, produced goods and services, and gets it on the market and enables the people to have the buying power to move those goods and services from producer to consumer. And there's different ways you can go about that that we could talk about in terms of reforms, but that I think would be a little bit beyond the scope of this particular podcast. We can do that on another one and talk about some remedies, some different ideas that are floating around if we did end the Fed. And there's been a lot of interesting things that have come down the pike in my own news beat over the last few years in that regard. But we'll save that for another time. Sufficient to say that what they're talking about here should be big news everywhere. Even the organizing body that put it on did put, as we've noted, some reasonably good information out there. It's not hard. These reporters need to put their lattes down for 5 minutes and crawl out of their internet cubicles and do some real work. And if me and an AFP associate can almost crawl up to New Hampshire so tired we couldn't even see straight, where are these news organizations with all their resources? What are they doing here? I'm not blowing our own horn for AFP. More, I'm rapping on the others. We had to travel all night to get there. It took as long in that bus as it takes to fly from New York City to Switzerland. 8 hours in the bus is the same amount of time it takes to fly over the ocean. And we got up there and back for a little over $100 each on the bus, not counting the rental car. So they can't get up there?
They absolutely could. They were told not to. And that really should be the question that should be on everybody's mind is why? Why were the mainstream media absent? The article that was just written by Pete Papaheraklis for American Free Press about this, Soros convenes Bretton Woods too, says in here that Soros said, and of course Soros's real name in this article, it's Georgie Schwartz. So Georgie Schwartz said, reorganizing the world order will need to extend beyond the financial system. Schwartz, Soros, is saying that a washed up America should be replaced by a world government with a global currency under UN rule. He also advocates that China should be top dog while we play second fiddle. These are things that Schwartz, Soros, actually said and believes in. Isn't that true?
As far as we can determine, this is his outlook, and his Japan Times Online article that sort of set the tone for the Bretton Woods II conference is a very revealing article. I don't have the whole thing in front of me right now as we speak, but this doesn't bode well for America, because even if these guys and gals had the best intentions in mind, I just don't think that this sort of approach would work anyway. There's just too much of a presumption of their infallibility, this idea that they know it all and that the masses have no role in this, that even Congress's job is really just to rubber stamp whatever legislation or legislative proposals they hobble together based on recommendations from meetings like this. Congress is supposed to control the purse strings, and that doesn't just mean writing up a budget or deciding how much revenue is coming in and how many expenditures are going out. Controlling the purse strings also means controlling the actual creation of money. That's supposed to be a function, a sovereign function of government. Government really should have four branches: legislative, judicial, executive, and monetary. That should not be privatized and allowed to be completely directed by private for-profit interests, at the top of which is the Federal Reserve System. And that feeds this whole network of economists and think tanks and the London School of Economics, you know, this breeder school for people to go into the banking realm. So a lot could be said about this, but American Free Press, gladly, a little bit belatedly, but we're really going at it as best we can. I think we're going to draw a lot of interest in our coverage of this and Trilats and Bilderberg and the current and upcoming future issues of the paper in the near term. Because it's time for a new press, Dave. It's not just time to call attention to these brigands and pirates of international finance. It's time for a new press. And these things help AFP gain an identity and gain recognition. We did drum up some interest up there in New Hampshire in our paper, and we're going to get some circulation up there in that area, and that's important. Wherever we make a splash, we can begin circulating our message on a more steady basis. So I'm always cautiously optimistic, despite the many things that give us reason to kind of retreat and sometimes back down. It's so overwhelming sometimes what we're up against. Centuries of unaccountable power, particularly in the banking realm, where they don't feel they have to answer to anyone from the Fed on down through the system. At any rate, I'm glad that we can keep an eye on it. I'm glad we're breaking some of these stories and doing our best with what resources we have, and I think we'll get good results.
Yeah, Mark, I want to thank you for the time you took explaining all this to the listeners. And again, to me, the most remarkable thing of this whole event is the fact, again, that the mainstream media was invisible. That's why it's more important than ever, like you said, for people to discover American Free Press, to find out what American Free Press is writing about. American Free Press really cares about people. That's one thing that always stood out in my mind, is that they write from the heart. They care about the average American.
Yeah, and by extension, the average person in any country that's facing this sort of tyranny and autocratic behind the scenes, behind the throne rule. Sometimes the truth is a very unpopular thing. Human nature, people want to retreat into their escapist recreation, and hey, we all have to do that a little bit, but you have to face reality too for a better tomorrow.
Thank you, Mark. Again, thanks for the time you took explaining this to the listeners. Thanks for going up there, and we're looking forward to the next update on this Bretton Woods 2 conference.
We'll see you next time, and all those listening out there, hang in there.